If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, August the 20th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow here at the Hoover Institution. My guest today in our studio, deep in the heart of the campus of Stanford University, is Colonel Mark Tillman, United States Air Force retired. A graduate of Tulane University with a degree in chemical engineering, Colonel Tillman's Air Force career spanned 30 years. His flying experiences included time as a T-37 instructor pilot for undergraduate pilot training, C-130 transport pilot, VIP airlift as a pilot in the Gulfstream 3 and 4, and here's why he's here today. Selected by the White House as America's 12th presidential pilot, Colonel Tillman served President George W. Bush as pilot and commander of Air Force One from 2001 to 2009. During that time, he flew the president to all but one of the 50 states. Vermont was the lone holdout, right, Mark?
Absolutely.
And he also flew the president on 49 overseas missions to 75 countries. This, of course, means that Colonel Mark Tillman was in command of Air Force One on the morning of September the 11th, 2001, and that's the subject of this podcast, recalling the events of that day. What it taught us about both preparation and response. Colonel Tillman, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So we'll get into 9/11 for a minute, but let's first talk about what drew you to the Air Force and flying. You watch movies, and pilots invariably are kids who are flying from the age of three. I was watching the awful movie Pearl Harbor. Well, I'm sorry, it's not awful. It's a bad movie, actually. Pearl Harbor with Ben Affleck, and in the movie he's flying a crop duster in Tennessee when he's just barely can see over the dials. But when did you first get interested in flying?
You know, as a young kid, I always wanted to fly, but it was too expensive at the time. I was son of a construction worker, so we just didn't have the money to do it. So joined the Air Force so they would pay for my schooling. That was the selfish thing I did.
Right.
Four-year degree is they only wanted 4 years of payback, so I thought that'd be great. So I did that, and then after graduation, became a rocket propulsion engineer for the Air Force with a chemical engineering degree, and then everybody around me were pilots, so after talking to them, they said, hey, you got to go do this. It's the coolest thing ever. So I thought, all right. So I started flying with the Air Force at that point, 2 years into my commitment, and from then never looked back. It's flying's been an incredible opportunity, and I've been all over the world.
Tell me about the path that puts you onto Air Force One. Does the service just keep an eye out for top talent and kind of draw that talent toward Air Force One, or is there a certain program you take? Is there a message board that shows job? How do you end up being an Air Force One pilot?
You know, what happens is you apply to the 89th Airlift Wing at Andrews Air Force Base that flies senators, congressmen, first lady, and vice president.
Right.
So they select from the United States Air Force. You go there, you interview. Usually they bring in 13 to 15 folks. They pick eight, and you fly for them, you talk with them, and then once they pick you, then they give you a plane, and then usually you're flying the vice president or first lady, maybe some congressmen or senators. And then from that group, Air Force One picks, we only had eight pilots, the presidential pilot,
right,
and then seven other pilots. So from that group at Andrews Air Force Base, you kind of pick from the best of the best. So it's a highly selective process, but it's a, you know, Air Force One is, you look at the guys, how well they fly, and most people that are there fly pretty good.
Right.
It's more about their ability to work and play with others and be able to fly while at the same time you got a dignitary standing behind you, talking to you, letting you know his viewpoints. And you know, everybody does the same thing. You just, wow, that's amazing, sir. You know, that's incredible what you just told me. So
what is the blend of exhilaration and terror the first time that you are taking off on a 747, knowing that the President of the United States' life is in your hands?
You know, you've trained so hard, you don't even think about the president downstairs. So my first mission with President Clinton was going into Akron, Ohio, a small airfield. First time I'd flown the president, so I've got to go land on the smallest runway the 747 can handle. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there was a big pucker factor, but, you know, I was concentrating as hard as I could, and I honestly never would have guessed the president was right below me. It was just one of those things where you're flying and you're doing everything perfect because you got – it's more the idea of the guys around you, ladies around you, they expect the best out of you, and you just don't want to let them down. So
right. Let's talk about 9/11. So it's a day that starts out like – a lot of days in an early administration, and people forget it's less than eight months into the Bush 43 administration. You have flown Air Force One to Sarasota. Where were you, at Sarasota Braden International?
Right, we were in Sarasota. The trip was a simple education visit to the state of Florida. First day Jacksonville, then fly to Sarasota, spend the night.
Yeah, he's in Florida. He's pushing No Child Left Behind, and he's also working a state, even though it's very early. He barely wins Florida. Without Florida, he doesn't get elected or reelected, so he's out politicking. So like John Kennedy going to Dallas in 1963. There's a political aspect to this. It's a nice day in Florida. Actually, I saw you describe, you actually said of the weather in New York City that day, you called it a clear in a million day. Interesting phrase.
Yeah, it's pretty much with pilots. Clear million miles visibility. I mean, it's just, it was amazing when we saw the pictures of the first tower getting hit, you knew that it wasn't an aircraft accident as such, because you can't miss a tower. But you got to think about it, you know. And what we were told was it was a light plane that hit the tower.
Right.
All of us that saw the initial pictures knew that it was a fairly large aircraft to make a hit like that. So it from that point on, it became very obvious that something was happening in the.
Right. Now, when the day starts to get crazy, you already have started firing up. You're getting Air Force ready to leave anyway, right?
Yeah, the president's plan was he was going to go meet with the students, and then we were going to have the president come back to us, and our plan was to head back to Washington, D.C.
Right.
So we had fueled with the standard fuel to get to Washington, reserve fuel, and then fuel in the case of any kind of national emergency to get the president safe. So we were ready to go. So arriving at the aircraft, that was the plan of attack for everybody.
So what is the moment, Mark, when the day spins out of control, and the day goes from just a simple flight back to Andrews to now what for the first time do we do, taking the president airborne? And let's talk a bit also about how the information passes here, because there's a great story in Politico on this, which gives a whole TikTok, and I'm very curious as to chain of command and also decisions. So you have to rev up Air Force One, but when does a decision come to you to take Air Force One up and go in a direction other than Andrews?
You know, what happened is once we started seeing all the issues on television, Air Force One did not have the capability for satellite TV at that time. So we had tuners. So we were tuning in local news stations, kind of like the old rabbit ears on your television. So we had local news stations, CBS, NBC, ABC. So NBC pretty much, you know, Today's Show, we were watching that as well as others. And so we saw the first tower get hit. We knew it was an issue, but our command and control at that time said it was an aircraft accident. And the president was briefed that, and we heard that, because we listened to all the radios that the president's listening and being on. So at that point, it was an aircraft accident. Shortly after the second tower was attacked, then it became basically now we are under attack, we're at war at this point. And everything changed at that point. My command and control authority for me is director of the White House Military Office. So a gentleman named Mark Rosenkirk called, gave me the heads up that the president's going to be moving shortly. He's going to be at the elementary school. He's going to be coming to us fast. And at that point, we were given the direction of we're going to execute basically an order where we're going to relocate the president, get him deep underground, get him somewhere for the continuity of government. As it continued on, we kept watching the television. They kept showing the president at the elementary school. And it was just painful because, we wanted to move now. We wanted to get the president out of there. But he was talking with the students, and then he addressed the nation. And then he moved back into the room next door. And then finally, we got the word that he's coming to us, but he has overridden the orders of relocating. We are actually going back to Washington, D.C. as he's coming towards us.
Well, he wants to go to Washington, D.C., but you're flying an airplane. You're in command of that ship.
True.
And you have to make the decision about that ship being safe. And to go back to Washington at that point is to take it into what is an unsafe airspace. You don't know what else is out there.
Yeah, it's not, you know, the captain of the ship, that kind of concept doesn't play when the commander-in-chief's on board. So the commander-in-chief can override anything he wants. So once he makes the decision with Andy Card, Andy Card advises this is what the president wants to do. We change the flight plans, which really no flight plan involved, just advise the FAA we're going to leave Sarasota, go to any altitude we want, any path we want, just keep clear of us. And, you can follow us, but don't talk to us. Don't give away our position.
Right.
And that's basically what we were going to do. But, I gave some you know, answered questions for Andy Carr because he was asking, where do you think we should take him as far as falling short of Washington, D.C. in the event we can't get into Washington? My suggestion was, let's hit Air Force bases along the East Coast. Andy Carr's plan was, let's get him back into Washington, D.C. And he's speaking for the president. He's downstairs with the president, and then he's coming upstairs to the cockpit. Mm-hmm. So we were aware of everything going on because the radio operators had everything on speaker because we had some of the senior staff, the NSC rep, as well as the White House military office commander sitting upstairs in the radio room. So we could hear the president's conversations with Dr. Rice, with the vice president. So we knew what was going on, and that's what I wanted. I wanted the situational awareness so that any move I made would be consistent with what the president's thinking downstairs.
And are you just on adrenaline at this point and instinct? At any point during this, are you reflecting on just how surreal this moment is?
You know, it's as a result of all the training. You know, I mean, we are trained. Everyone goes over the scenario to move the president in the event of nuclear attack, in the event of anything. So we're already in gear to do that, and we started moving in that direction. So once we decided we're heading towards Washington, D.C., it became, in a sense, a simple flight. But at the same time, we were told, okay, the Pentagon had been hit. Now, we're also being told numerous truck bombs, car bombs going off in the Capitol area.
Right.
So it didn't make much sense to take him into that environment, but that's what he wanted, and that's what we had to do. We had to make it safe, bring in other aircraft, fighter support, et cetera. So I spent most of my time trying to figure out, okay, what's the rest of the puzzle? You know, mm-hmm. is this the Russian thing where they're going to lead you into the Valley of Death and, you know, they're throwing a ruse up to you and you got to figure out how to get in and out of there? So it was trying to figure out the best way to get him in there while trying to get good information from the Air Force, all the intelligence agencies, and we got that great information. You know, and as the president started moving towards that way, it became obvious that going to Washington wasn't the answer. And that came as a result of the airliner that crashed in Shanksville. You know, that airliner was on its way toward Washington. When we left Sarasota, there was a decision Andy Carr and the others thought about, well, let's take them to Camp David. So I started rallying planes to us land in, say, Jackson, Mississippi, 747, get into a smaller aircraft, take them into Hagerstown, mm-hmm. and get them to Camp David. But then as soon as that plane that was out of Shanksville heading towards Washington, D.C., it made no sense to move them into the Hagerstown area.
Right.
You know, our whole scenario was the idea that all of these people that were creating the terrorist attack were in contact with each other, you know, and had a tremendous plan. You know, it wasn't until everything was complete that we realized how simple it was. However, you know, it caught us with our pants down. And there was tremendous communication gaps throughout the day between us and the ground, first responders, et cetera.
Right. So Air Force One makes its way from Sarasota to Barksdale in Louisiana.
Yes.
And this caught me as interesting, Mark, as I was reading up on this. The request goes in for fuel, sandwiches, and 25 pounds of bananas. Now, is the president a banana fan, or is potassium an aid in flying? What's the deal with 25 pounds of bananas?
The concept was when we landed in Barksdale, we had a full plane, reporters as well. So, you know, I think the 25 pounds of bananas got confused. I mean, the goal was to get enough sandwiches and fruit and everything
for everybody to feed people
on the ground because we weren't going to let them loose. We're going to keep them on the plane because we had no idea when the president was going to come back to us. I assumed he was going to be there anywhere from 15 to 24 hours underground, and the crew couldn't leave, nor could the passengers. We weren't going to let the news leave. And then Ari Fleischer's and others made the decision, okay, let's bring in another plane, get the media off of the plane, move them back to Washington, D.C., keep them moving, and keep a select group on the aircraft with us. So as soon as that occurred, and the president, plus, he came back to us a lot earlier than we thought he would. So the food wasn't a requirement. But it was, once again, it was getting the whole crew together and asking each person what they needed. Mm-hmm. Tina Stein, the head flight attendant, said, I've got enough food for one leg to Washington, but if we're going to sit here for four or five meals, I'm going to need more food. So that was her requirement.
Right. So most people who fly commercially are familiar with having two pilots. And you always end up spending time at the gate waiting for the two pilots to show up, and they check in and off they go and away you go, and they're used to, you know, two or three maybe flight attendants on their plane. How many people does it take to fly Air Force One?
You know, normally up front you have three pilots, two navigators, mm-hmm. four to five radio operators, four to five security forces, 10 to 12 flight attendants. Usually it's a crew anywhere from 26 to 32. Wow. And then the passengers are usually 69 passengers plus the first family. Mm. So it's it's an enormous plane, but it's got very low seating capability.
So how many of you were up front actually flying the plane? How many pilots and co-pilots?
On that day, we ended up with, I made the takeoff out of Sarasota. I moved out of the cockpit to talk with the Secret Service and Andy Card. Mm-hmm. So the two other pilots flew over Gainesville heading towards Washington, D.C. Then once we started giving each other breaks, but for the most part, I was in the back talking with the NSC representative as well as Andy Card and many of the others.
So given that number of pilots, Mark, how long could that plane stay up in the air? I'm assuming that maybe you could can the plane refuel in the air, or do you have to do it on the ground?
Yeah, the plane is air refuelable.
Okay.
So we could have actually refueled in the air. No reason to do it, though. I mean,
right.
we were not under an attack as such as that. It was easier to land, have the president talk with people at Barksdale Air Force Base. We filled the plane up completely full of fuel at Barksdale Air Force Base, so we had the capability to fly for 14 hours. Just no reason to keep flying coast to coast with the president. So kind of had to have a place to put them down. And Barksdale was picked mainly because it's, at the time, a Strategic Air Command or Air Combat Command base,
right?
B-52s,
yeah.
Tremendous security.
Interesting. Okay, let's talk about the takeaways from this day. Did you sit down and actually file a report and talk about lessons learned from this?
You know, I talked with the White House afterwards. We had an after action over at the White House. Mainly it was more involved with security breaches, how we can increase security, what could be of a concern to everybody. I went back to the unit at Air Force One and asked everybody, okay, you know, it sounds kind of morbid, but how would you kill the President of the United States from this point forward so we could hit every possible way to attack him? You know, what a lot of people don't understand is the actual National Geographic, the first series came out under President Clinton, where they gave a timeline of Air Force One, which
right.
was takeoff minus a couple hours, takeoff plus, and they laid out the entire timeline of Air Force One. Shortly after September 11th, we got word that there was a group of terrorists in the Maryland area that were watching that movie, and they sat down and they filled out, you know, basically talked with each other about how they could enter Air Force One, attack Air Force One, and that they were going to steal uniforms, etc. So at that point, you know, it became obvious that we had to change everything. So we changed all the security requirements inside of Air Force One as a result of the movie. We changed our uniforms. Our people that were making our uniforms, we asked them, hey, has anybody tried to come to you? And they said, you know, it's unusual. Somebody came by here asking us, you know, if there was any way they could buy an Air Force
somebody
One
uniform.
Somebody
posing as a pilot.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, once we learned that, we took all uniforms off. And we all showed up in civilian clothes all the time because we didn't want to be targets for the local community. So President Bush made a great decision on that, though. When he found out that we had taken our uniforms off, President Bush advised me that that's not the plan. We are the United States military. We are proud to wear our uniforms, and we're going to get them right back on again. You are the crew of Air Force One. So, and that's all I needed was, okay, understand the threat level here, but you know, we are the United States military.
On non-9/11 days, Mark, when Air Force One is in the air, what is the protocol for commercial airspace? Is there just like a river or a canal that Air Force One goes through and airplanes have to stay out of? How do they clear the way for it?
You know, the normal air traffic separation while we're airborne traveling along. However, once we get to the airfield, though, we get immediate priority. So what they'll start doing is stacking up airliners,
right.
Send them into holding, try to accelerate them to give us a path when we come in, anywhere from a 5 to 7 minute path,
right.
So that we're the only plane on final. And as we come in on final, everything's been cleared out. So we have an orchestrated movement. So when we touch down, we know where we're going to taxi, which taxiways, et cetera. Secret Service knows that they're following us. So we know what the protocol is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be very unusual to change that and have somebody clear us in a different taxiway. But they need to move all planes off, and they have to hold them at the gates, et cetera, which is not, you know, as a pilot, it's incredible when you go to a place like O'Hare, you go to LaGuardia, you know, anywhere, JFK, where all the airliners are stacked up on a taxiway, and then you taxi down the runway, turn around, and go ahead of all of them.
This was my next question, if you've had the distinct honor of really messing up air traffic. LAX, we're in California, so LAX is maybe the worst example of this. When Clinton was in office, mm-hmm. he would come out to California a lot more than Bush 43.
Absolutely.
And you land in LAX. I remember reading the stories at the time. time mark, just the very few minutes it takes to land Air Force One and get out of the way. That 5 minutes or whatever just makes a hash out of flights that day.
It does. And the air traffic controllers do an amazing job taking care of that. You know, there's in Atlanta one time, one of the airliners, the pilot hadn't toggled to the PA. He actually still talked on the radios. And so as we're taxiing down the runway, he made the comment to everybody, if you look left, you'll see your president delaying traffic and costing thousands of dollars for all of us waiting here in line. You know, so if you get a chance, let the president know exactly what he's doing to the American people. And then, but the good part was when he was done talking on the radio, all the other airline pilots, you know, came back, hey, buddy, give him a break. That's President Bush, you know, and then from then on, all the airliners are click, 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 you know, saying, hey, let, you know, that's, we support right. this, be quiet.
I wrote a column a few years ago about Obama and California, and just, you know, it's a very Democratic state, and just what it would take for Obama to lose California. So I actually went back and I figured how many times he came here on Air Force One and said, okay, each time he comes in and he lands, not only would he land in the afternoon and mess up traffic, Mark, but then he'd get in a motorcade and, you know, make a mess out of rush hour traffic. So I said, okay, given his margin of victory here, he'd have to make about 10,000 people a trip mad at him to eventually lose the state. But the next president of the United States, whoever's in office in 2004, Mark, will have the pleasure of flying on a new Air Force One. There is a redesign coming out. It's the first redesign. Well, actually, two things here. First of all, Trump wants to physically redesign the appearance of Air Force One, change it from robin's egg blue to red, white, and blue. I guess JFK was the Kennedy presidency. It was the last time this was done. But whoever's in office in 2004, Mark, gets a new plane. It's also, it's a 747, right?
It's a 747, and it's just a little larger than the one we have now.
Yeah, it's a 747-8i, which means it's about 20 feet longer mm-hmm. than the current version.
Yes.
If you got on board that plane, would you recognize it?
You know, I think you will. I think the way the presidency needs to be on that aircraft is it needs to be an aircraft that, you know, it's not like other countries where there's gold sinks and, you know, door handles, et cetera. Air Force One is, you know, the American aircraft. It is, you know, light carpeting, beige, there's leather seating. It's a business casual aircraft. And mm-hmm. that's kind of what it needs to be. It shows the American people exactly what, you know, the president doesn't need to be on a lavish aircraft. He needs right. to be on an aircraft that is comfortable, has tremendous communications, tremendous self-defense. And that's what the new aircraft, that's what the design of the new aircraft will be. The paint scheme is a mark of what Air Force One has always been about. It's a legacy. It's right. important. When Air Force One arrives on the soil of a foreign country, they don't need to see something you know, flashy, et cetera. They need to see Air Force One coming in, and it's a symbol because it's a symbol of the American people. And when the president gets off, it needs to be just that. They need to know that America stands strong, and the American president coming off is coming to talk with that country, either help that country or come together with that country. It isn't a statement of, hey, we are here, we are, we're the Americans, right. move out of our way. It's you know, Air Force One the way it is now is a beautiful aircraft with the, you know, presidential seal, United States of America, and most important on the tail, lit up by two lights, is the American flag.
Are you saying you don't like the scheme as it's been presented?
Not at all. No, that's not what we're about. This is, it's Air Force One. It's President of the United States. It's a class outfit.
Some people say it looks a little too much like back when there was a Trump era, it looks a little too much like a Trump airplane with that color scheme.
That could be. It's not what I would push for.
Were you scared on 9/11? Was there a point where you were afraid?
It wasn't so much afraid of what could happen. It was more afraid of if I would fail the President of the United States. I mean, 30 crew members, multiple other aircraft under my command to do things for the president. You know, there was a lot of fog of war, a lot of miscommunication, and I really had to listen to these speakers and radios and try to understand exactly what they wanted, to be one step ahead of them, keep moving aircraft into position mm-hmm. to service as to what we needed. Our communication failed after we got airborne,
right.
which was bad in a sense that, you know, the president still had communication to talk with the vice president. He had about three phone lines out of about 40. But our
couldn't do video, right?
He could not do video. Yeah. That was never a capability we had. He could talk with the people on the ground. And he could talk with National Command Authority. However, of those phone lines, the majority of them were commercial capability. Mm-hmm. The airliners took a lot of the commercial capability, so we were saturated on all the phone lines. So our radio operators came up with basically using satellites only designed for nuclear attacks, satellites taken from the war fighters, et cetera. And they came and they got the president the communication he needed. But President Bush made a great comment at the end of September 11th and said, hey, this plane is incapable of supporting me in time of attack, and you need to change it now. So we did. We put internet capability, streaming video, phone lines. We had capability now, more satellite capability, more priority on commercial satellites as well. So, you know, we changed everything in less than a month. So it was an incredible amount of what industry did for us as well as the United States Air Force.
So, Mark, what is commercial Wi-Fi? When I fly commercially, why does my Wi-Fi still stick?
You know, our Wi-Fi was a dedicated link. We were the first aircraft pretty much to have not Wi-Fi, but hardwired capability. The concern with us was always with Wi-Fi was, as you're taxiing up and the president's using Wi-Fi, somebody on the outside could intercept it. So all of our internet was hardwired capability, and it would be encrypted, et cetera. So, you know, we had that capability, but it was extremely low downlinks, and uplinks were not that bad. But we had DirecTV at this point. So once we got DirecTV and satellite capability, the plane became highly capable.
Right.
And so, I mean, that was – so for the first year, you know, even then you couldn't do internet capability overseas, streaming video. We just didn't have – you know, there just wasn't any satellite capability for us. It was just mainly spot beam was here in the United States. So, right. You know, developed a lot of capability once that programming started.
So when I was putting together my notes for this podcast, Mark, I had my TV on as a little background noise, and I kid you not, it was on Showtime, and there was the movie Air Force One, 1997, Harrison Ford. You told me before we went on the air that you met Harrison Ford in Jackson Hole, I think you said, to talk about the film production.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. President Clinton was in Jackson Hole vacationing, and as we sat there putting the plane to bed, a gentleman rode up on a motorcycle, a helmet, and came up. Our guards stopped him, and as he pulled up, he took his helmet off, and the guards are like, oh, my God, it's Harrison Ford. So he talked to us, and he said they're, you know, about to make a movie called Air Force One. So
right.
I called my boss, a guy named Danny Barr, who was over in Idaho Falls with the 747, and said, hey, Harrison Ford wants to take a look at the big jet. So he did. He flew over there himself. He took a look at the big jet. We ended up getting the script so we could read it. And it was a great action adventure. It was kind of hilarious. And, you know, and the neat part is after they filmed the movie and it went out to the public, they gave a copy to President Clinton so we could all watch it going from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And then they had the crew come out and to the movie theaters and watch it, the initial screening. But we saw it on the plane. President Clinton saw it on the way out to LAX. So that night, President Clinton was kind of famous for going to LAX, dinner, and then we'd do a red eye back home. So the basically, when he comes back to LAX, you know, the people that are on the local news station asked the president if he saw the move, and he said, yeah, he did. And they said, well, does it have an escape pod? You know, and President Clinton goes, you know, I don't know. So when he came up to the cockpit heading home, he came up there, and my boss, a guy named Mark Donnelly, we're all in the cockpit, and he asks us, you know, does the plane have an escape pod? And we're all, no. Sorry, right. You know, Mr. President doesn't have it.
Right, because so, in the movie, the agents take him to the back of the plane, and then they drop the pod out of the plane to make it look like he's escaped the plane when in fact he's dead on
board. That's what he ends up doing. So it makes it look like he's no longer on the aircraft, that they've lost the president.
So a question you must get asked every time, Mark, when you do interviews like this, can the plane defend itself?
The plane is highly capable.
And what can you say?
The plane is highly capable.
Next question.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you're not going to get into details.
It's the same question you get about the White House being able to defend itself. What does it have there that can fend off an attack? So the plane can try to avert a missile.
Absolutely.
Attack is what you're trying
highly
to say.
Capable.
So you watched the movie, Air Force One. You watched it.
Yeah, I watched the movie Air Force One. And
you said that kind of grudgingly.
No, it was a great action adventure. And it was, you know, and there's a lot of things in the movie that couldn't happen on the actual Air Force One.
Yes.
You know, rogue agents and that kind of stuff is, you know, there isn't an armory on board the plane for the exact reason of someone getting into the armory. You know, every person that carries a weapon has to keep that weapon with them. Yeah, you don't have weapons laying around. So everyone's responsible for the weapon, and you know where every weapon's at. So,
right.
You know, it's not a scenario where someone just comes on the plane and can break into the armory, get weapons, and attack folks. So.
Did they get the design of the plane right in terms of look and feel? You watch the film, and the president comes on board, and he goes to his private area, and he's watching TV and sitting at a desk and things like that. Is the layout compatible?
You know, the layout's almost exact. I mean, the conference room was the same in the movie Air Force One, as well as the radio room. And the cockpit is extremely different, but where the president sits and everything else is extremely accurate, with the exception of the spiral staircases and, like, the 7-Eleven coolers down in the basement. But for the most part, you know, they did some good modeling of the plane when they made the movie.
So I got to ask, if they did the version of your movie, your story, you know, they did the Flight 93 movie, but if they did the Air Force One version of this, who plays you? Actually, your wife's in the other room. We should ask her.
You know, it'd be good to have someone like, you know, a good lookalike like George Clooney or somebody like that might be a good one.
Brad Pitt's up too.
Or Brad Pitt would probably be even closer, yes.
There was a joke in the movie Moneyball, Mark. There was a fellow who was an assistant GM for the Oakland A's. It's about the Oakland Athletics baseball team. And the fellow who they based the character on the film goes to off to the Dodgers. But in the movie, he's played by Jonah Hill. The comedian, just fat, roly-poly guy, just, that's not how you want to be immortalized on screen.
Absolutely. No, I think a movie on Air Force One, you know, for September 11th, you know, the key to everything is the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Air Force One was a tool for the president on that day. But if someone could just show the decisions president made, the decisions Dr. Rice, the vice president, everyone made, I think they'd be amazed at, you know, how much information was being passed to the president and what kind of decisions he was making with that information. I mean, he sat there on a plane. I mean, everyone knows flying, you're not going a lot of places. You're sitting there, and he's getting information constantly. So, you know, that's hard to model, but it'd be great to have somebody, you know, if we could have recorded everything the president heard and, you know, and basically saw on the television, et cetera, and saw the decisions. You know, when he wrote the book Decision Points, it was a great thing because it gave everybody an idea of what he had to, you know, decisions he made based on the information he had at the time.
Yeah, it's a lot of people have said this is sort of when he finds his footing as a president. He was less than 8 months on the job. He does not win the popular vote. He's still kind of scrambling to get his footing, but this is his test.
Absolutely.
Okay, favorite mission on Air Force One? Favorite flight?
You know, for me, being an aviation person, after the shuttle disaster disintegrating over Texas, the funeral, we left Washington, D.C. with John Glenn and Neil Armstrong. So I let the flight attendants know if there's any chance that these gentlemen would want to come to the cockpit, you know, carry them on your shoulders, bring them up. And no sooner did they get on board, they came to the cockpit. So behind me was John Glenn. To the right of me in the engineer's seat was Neil Armstrong. And they sat there from takeoff to landing at Houston Ellington. They're telling us stories and they're talking to us. And the two of them are going back and forth, joking with each other. And, you know, the neat part for me was we have to land to the second. So as I'm coming into Ellington, I'm about 30 seconds ahead. So kind of a standard technique is to overshoot final, then the roll back in. You'll lose about 20 seconds.
Right.
No sooner do I start to do that than John Glenn moves up and he puts his hands on my shoulders and he goes, "Sonny, the airport's right there." So he thought I couldn't see it, you know. So from then on, everybody's joking with me, "Sonny, you know, John Glenn had to tell you where Houston Ellington was." But, you know, I've got pictures of that. You know, it's just the neatest thing ever as far as I'm concerned.
I was going to ask you, a photo of the two of them in the same place at the same time is a rarity.
It is. And it was just, you know, I've got that sitting in my I Love Me wall at home. And it's
like my friend who has a baseball bat that has both DiMaggio and Ted Williams signature on it.
Cool.
You don't find these too often. And outside of 9/11, Mark, what was the toughest flight on Air Force One? Was it taking him back to Texas at the end of the presidency?
No, going back home with President Bush was the coolest thing ever, mainly because the first half of the flight was his staff from the first 4 years of his administration. Then when we landed in Midland, Texas, the staff from the second half of his administration got on board, and the first family walked around the aircraft thanking everybody for the great things they did for him. So to have, you know, the President Bush and Mrs. Bush come walking up to you and thank you for, you know, a great 8 years and a job well done is, you know, I'll never forget that. That for me, that's one of the highlights of my career is the fact that, you know, the president and the first lady were always so nice to the military.
Right.
You know, and that was, you know, that's kind of, most presidents are like that, but you could really feel it as the military says all the time. You could feel President Bush coming to you and, he understood a lot of the decisions he made, and he was going to always be there for us.
I have a peripheral Bush connection. I worked on his father's failed reelect in 1992, so I guess I technically qualify for Bush World. I've yet to meet anyone, Mark, who has a bad thing to say about working for either 41 or 43. And I guess you're thankful because that's also how you met your wife.
Absolutely.
Erin Witcher Tillman, who, full disclosure, is the Director of Communications here at Hoover, and she is the person who made you available today. So thank her or blame her. But couple final questions here. So now, looking back now, we're approaching the 18th anniversary of 9/11. What would you have done differently? What could have been done differently in terms of the response? I mean, hindsight's always 20/20, but this gets back to the idea of lessons learned. What could have or maybe should have been done differently?
You know, I always wonder if I could have just taken off from quicker takeoff coming out of Sarasota, go direct Washington, D.C.
Shotgun it back to Andrews.
And yeah, just get him back to Andrews, get him back into where he's comfortable, into his surroundings, and just hunker him down and get him back there.
But there's no place, this gets back to the Flight 93 situation, nobody knows what's safe. Nobody knows if you're a target in Air Force One. Nobody knows if the White House is a target. Nobody knows if there's a truck bomb out there.
No, absolutely.
There is no safe place to park them except on that airplane.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, we had old mentality at that point as far as hunkering them down in some location, relying on the communications. You know, he made a decision. He wanted to get back to Washington. So, you know, I could have timed it better where we found out what the plane in Shanksville was about to do, the crash in Shanksville, and then get him in there shortly after that. But, you know, we maneuvered him back into the Midwest and, you know, and kept delaying getting him home. And, you know, in his mind, he really wanted to get back to Washington. And as it ended up toward the end of the day, it was great that he got back there because now he could gather everybody. But the neat part was on the aircraft, all the people he would have talked to in Washington, D.C. were on that aircraft with him, Andy Card, you know, Dan Bartlett, everybody else. So, it, you know, that's the only, you know, thing that I could have probably done better.
The only challenges would have been, I guess, talking to Cheney, who's in this situation. He's in the basement of the White House, and Rumsfeld, who's at the Pentagon, but the Pentagon's under attack, so you can't get there. So, quite a full house.
Yeah, we had communications that let him talk to a lot of people.
Right.
As a result of reduced communications, we ended up being almost single node, going right to the vice president, passing information back to the plane. So, you know, hindsight, the way things are going to operate today is, you know, have better capability to talk to, say, Rudy Giuliani, you know, the mayor of New York City. That was a challenge to get us hooked into, you know, all the first responders. Everybody was on different frequencies. Everybody had different, you know, radio capability. So,
have you seen video of Giuliani that day?
I have, yes.
Running literally for his life down the streets of Manhattan. It's incredible.
Yes, and he was on the plane after that. And you know, you can say what you want about him, but when he came to the cockpit, he was a great man, demanded respect from you, and just talked with you, just a good man. He did some great things for the people in New York, in my mind.
A couple more questions, we'll wrap up. Were you with Bush when he went to Yankee Stadium?
I was. I brought him up to flew him up to New York, and he was wearing a, you know, kind of a bulletproof vest kind of thing because he was going to throw out the first pitch. And at that time, there were still numerous threats in New York. So as he's in the plane, he's lobbing the ball back and forth along the hallway of the aircraft, and he's ready for it. And then that's what we did. We sat on the plane, you know, every one of us praying to God that he's going to throw a strike. And sure enough, I mean, I look at that thing all the time when I give speeches. I throw, you know, show that picture of him throwing a strike there. And, you know, that was cool. That just brought America together, let everybody know, come on out and play ball.
It may have been the last kind of moment of bipartisanship in this country, sadly, 18 years ago, but it's an incredible moment. There are only 14 men who have been presidential pilots. I looked it up. You're number 12, and there are only 14 in the club right now. Is there an association? Do you guys talk? Do you get together? Is there any kind of bonding?
You know, every year there's a reunion in Washington, D.C., and mm-hmm. those of us can get there, we get there, but the rest of the time we're all talking to each other. The crew keeps in touch quite often if right. anybody needs anything. We always, as a crew of Air Force One, we're unique. I mean, we would keep in touch if anybody has a problem and you've got the answer and how to fix it, you get involved and you help that person. So everyone knows if you've got issues, you just let the word out that you need this, you need that, and one of us is going to come find a way to help you out. So mm-hmm. it's just a tight unit, and it's no different than the United States military. We, right. you know, one military man, woman needs something, we're all going to rally together and help each other.
So what do you miss most about not flying that big plane?
Yeah, you know, I miss the camaraderie, the people. I miss that's the biggest thing. But flying the 747 is an incredible plane.
Right.
It's so reliable. It's just, you know, it's a big shopping mall in the sky, but you can make a tight turn with it. You can bring it down. But the key to the whole thing is, you know, you've got those 18 wheels there, and the trucks are coming down, and if you drop, you know, 500,000 pounds from 10 feet, you are going to go kaboom.
Right.
So luckily in Decision Points, Mrs. Bush says that Tillman could land the plane, and that's all I needed. So I made some good soft landings for him, thank God.
And you still fly today?
I do. I fly for a corporate, for a company, and based out of California. And it's, you know, they've got a Global Express and a Citation jet. So I still fly all the time, which is, it's pretty much all I know in life at the moment.
So if money wasn't an object, Mark, what would you fly?
If tomorrow somebody called me from Air Force One and said, hey, we need you back, we need the old guy back or whatever, I'd snuggle into the uniform and be right back there flying the 747. I just love the plane and the mission and the military, and that's just what it's about. I think all of us in the military would say the same thing. You know, give us the call, let us come back. Bunch of old guy unit, we'd go ahead and kick some butt.
Could you still fly? I was watching the trailer for Top Gun at the movies the other day, and, you know, I did the math. Maverick has got to be pushing 60, and I have a hard time seeing him flying F-18s or 35s or whatever he is in. I have a hard time seeing the Navy giving him clearance to go off the ground. But are you fit right now to fly Air Force One? Could you get behind those?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's definitely I haven't lost the magic yet, so I'm very, very confident in my capability.
Very good. So how do you honor, how do you respect 9/11? What do you do that day?
You know, every 9/11, Aaron and I, we get up early so we can hear the tolling of the bells. We try to go to New York as much as we can and, we want to hear the tolling of the bells and read enough the names and not forget about all the people. It brings back some kind of weird thoughts for me, September 11th. And it's I don't like reading a lot of stuff about September 11th because I remember those days vividly. And I like to remember the great things about September 11th, all the people that came together after September 11th, how America was strong, how everybody were Americans. And, you know, I tell people this all the time. After September 11th, we traveled all around the world. And here in the United States, no matter what city we went to, we'd arrive and 3,000 to 4,000 people would be outside the rope lines at the jet yelling and screaming, USA, USA. No one was giving them a card telling them to say it. They're yelling and screaming it. You know, whether you like President Bush or not, it didn't matter. You were Americans, and we came together, and everybody did the same thing. You know, you hugged military when they got on the plane. You thanked them for their service. You did all kinds of things, and you thanked the American people. We were just together. And now, you know, now we, it's... We're supposedly together, but you're having to think about it, you know, and it's not right. I mean, we really need to come back to those days of mm-hmm. doesn't matter whether you're black or white or whatever, we're there. We're all Americans.
Colonel Mark Tillman, thank you for your service. Thank you for many years of flying our president safely around the globe. And thanks for sharing your wife with the Hoover Institution. We like having her here.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for being here.
You've been listening to Area 45. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. If you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for the Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover Fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. You, Colonel Tillman, are not on Twitter?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I'm probably very glad of that too, right?
Very happy.
However, if you don't want to read more about the events of 9/11, I highly recommend an article that ran in Politico magazine in September 2016. If you want to Google it, the headline of it, the title of the story is "We're the Only Plane in the Sky." That must have been surreal to be the only plane in the sky, Colonel Tillman. If you're an aviation buff, I also would refer you to a website. It's called iloveairforceone.com, which gives you all kinds of nerdy facts about the plane, how fast it goes, allegedly how fast it goes. I have a feeling it might go faster than is listed on that site, but we'll never know. You'll never tell me.
There you go.
Ken Walsh, who was a White House reporter for many years, wrote a book called Air Force One, A History of Presidents and Their Planes. That came out in, I think, 2003. Mm-hmm. Might want to recommend that as well. Anything else I should mention?
No, you've captured it all. Thank you so much.
Hey, for the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Till then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.